Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The future of Concord Mall under its new owners is getting cloudier with news that Sears, one of its major anchor stores, is closing.
One of the things that is troubling is that there is no clear path forward.
Contributor Eileen Dalabrida offers an update on what's happening with Concord Mall. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine Southbridge residents' hopes and fears about new development coming to the east side of Wilmington's riverfront, and tell you about a conference in Wilmington next week trying to help the First State enhance its place in the chemtech industry. Arts Playlist previews an organ concert coming next week to the University of Delaware, and Enlighten Me focuses on keeping seals safe along the state's coast. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. News of a new riverfront apartment building planned for A Street in South Wilmington has sparked discussion among nearby Southbridge residents about what's coming to the area and what it means for them. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt explores how anticipated development of Wilmington's second riverfront could impact residents of this historic neighborhood.
With the Western Christina Riverfront in Wilmington largely built out, planners, economic development officials, and developers are turning their attention to the Eastern Riverfront in South Wilmington. News of a fully amenitized apartment building to be built on A Street has gotten Southbridge residents talking about how to harness the coming growth to benefit their largely low-income community. A bridge over the Christina River connecting the two riverfronts is expected to open in June, and a multi-million dollar wetland park on the western edge of Southbridge, meant to improve stormwater management and beautify the area, is under construction. The 76ers Fieldhouse, recently built on South Market Street, is another massive investment in the area. Here's Megan McGlinchey of the nonprofit Riverfront Development Corporation addressing the area's prospects at the opening game at the Fieldhouse last year.
With the construction of the Christina River Bridge that will open hopefully in early 2020, we see now this side of the river, kind of the east bank. This is sort of the next frontier for riverfront development, so it's definitely an area that we'll be focused on for many years to come.
Jeff Flynn is Director of Economic Development for the City of Wilmington. He says the city hopes to modernize the riverfront parcels on the eastern bank so that their uses generate commerce and city revenue while creating opportunities for residents.
This area on the east bank of the Christina River, formerly industrial land uses, our vision is to bring a road network and create, new city blocks, very similar as to what was done on the west side of the river.
One residential project is already planned for A Street, which runs along the river toward the residential neighborhood of Southbridge. The 150-unit apartment complex will be called River House. Dominic Wicker is Vice President and Director of Development at Washington Place Equities, the Baltimore-based developer behind the project. He says the apartments will be market-rate and fully amenitized.
Concierge, staffing, sort of hotel-style lobby, fitness room, dog run, resident lounge on the lower level, rooftop deck, and then we think, the great amenity at the building is really going to be the proximity to the water.
Wicker says the goal is to break ground on the project this spring and have the first residents living there by the middle of next year. The developers plan to take advantage of tax breaks associated with the federal opportunity zone that covers most of the city, but that status was not the primary draw.
We're very encouraged by the city's investments in the wetland park, I think the shopping center, the big athletic center, and certainly the bridge. I mean, I think it all together, it really shows an awful lot of foresight and thinking and a vision that gets articulated by action. That's a very attractive thing to want to be a part of.
Marie Reed, president of the Southbridge Civic Association and a lifelong resident of the neighborhood, said on a rainy day just outside of Southbridge that she first learned of the project in news reports last month.
It would be nice if he did come to the Civic Association to share his plans with us. I know he doesn't have to, but as a good neighbor, it would be nice because we just want to know. You're coming to our community.
Reed says she prefers residential development to industrial, which is planned on the other side of Southbridge.
I like the apartment complex better than I like the cement grinding, slag grinding, because there is no environmental harms.
And she doesn't want to see Southbridge left behind.
I hope it turns out positive for the community, that they don't forget Southbridge, that we benefit from these things and benefit from the businesses, that they include us in their in their business somehow, as far as employment or access to their buildings. Where they're going on A Street, we're getting a new road put in. So that does benefit everybody, the roadage that is coming, the signage and things like that. Welcome to Southbridge. So yeah, and being a good neighbor.
Roxy Smiley Carter moved to Southbridge several years ago. She echoes Reed's hope for new development bringing employment.
I would hope that it would provide some jobs if it's for some of the residents who live here who need jobs.
City Council President and fourth generation Southbridge resident Hanifa Shabazz says she wants development that will not continue to, quote, hold down one part of the population, but raise that population up. At a Southbridge Civic Association meeting last month, Shabazz emphasized the importance of updating the 2006 Special Area Management Plan for the neighborhood, which was the genesis of the current Wetlands Park project. She notes the one section of the plan left unfinished would have addressed economic development. She says without a clear plan, gentrification is a possibility.
Well, it's always a risk of displacement if we're not prepared. And that's why we're so important about having a plan of action to address what this wave of development could do to a community such as ours, and make sure we put all the stop points and the supports in place so that displacement does not occur.
Shabazz says nearby development could become problematic for existing Southbridge residents in the event of a reassessment of property values, which has not happened countywide since the 1980s.
If assessment comes through Southbridge and they assess us along with the other properties around us, we will be taxed out of being able to cover the property taxes on our homes because their values of their houses are so high and our values of our houses are so low.
Marie Reed says she's already feeling pressure.
I got a letter from a real estate company. It told me, thank you for expressing interest in selling your home. I didn't express interest in selling my home.
But Flynn says displacement through gentrification is far less of a concern in Wilmington than other cities. The city's economic development director cites the fact that in the absence of a new general reassessment, property tax assessments do not increase merely as a result of an increase in value at a neighboring property. He says rent prices in Wilmington don't spike the way they do in some other cities. And he cites the development of the West Riverfront a decade ago.
I remember the concerns in the Browntown and Hedgeville communities about rents increasing. My observation is that that did not occur. I don't have the data in front of me, but my sense is that if we looked at the data in those two neighborhoods, you might see the rents increase like they did nationwide in the years from 2000 to 2007 or 2008, but then they dropped with the Great Recession. They've come up a little bit, but I don't think they've actually surpassed 2007 rates.
Wicker, developer of the planned complex on A Street, does not see displacement of existing Southbridge residents as a result of new development in the near or intermediate term. He says the impact of nearby development should be positive.
In a perfect world, you would think that you've got younger people living on the river and who then start to choose to move on in life, maybe invest in a for sale or, you know, ownership situation, and like the neighborhood and want to stay in the neighborhood. You know, we certainly see that in other markets that we're in.
Shabazz maintains that Southbridge will need to be active in harnessing the energy around the Eastern Riverfront.
We're a low-income community, and so for us not to think of how do we improve the economic status of our community, especially when you got a $35 million project coming up the street, how do we get the benefit of that redevelopment? I mean, the status of the community is going to change with such a facility coming. We're just saying spread the love.
In South Wilmington, Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. And stay with us. We have an update on Concord Mall's future in the wake of more bad news for the shopping center that recently changed owners. That's next on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. 2 weeks ago, we looked at Concord Mall's change in ownership and what it could mean for the North Wilmington Shopping Center. Shortly after contributor Eileen Dalabrita brought us that story, word came that Sears is closing its store at the mall, taking away one of Concord Mall's three anchor stores. And Macy's, one of the other anchor stores, announced it is shuttering one-fifth of its department stores nationwide, though it's uncertain if Concord Mall will be on that list. In the wake of these developments, Eileen brought us a follow-up to her original story, a piece you can find right now at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to update what we know about Concord Mall's fate. Well, let's start with perhaps, I guess, the biggest and clearest news we've gotten since your previous reporting on this story, and that is that Sears is closing at Concord Mall. Tell us a little bit about how soon it's going away, and what does it mean for the mall and its new owner?
Sears is going away over the course of about the next 2 months. And it means that if there's no new tenant to replace Sears, it gives shoppers one less reason to go to the mall, which makes things even more challenging for the retailers who are left behind.
And as I recall, the mall does not own the Sears space, correct? So how does filling it work, and what could go there based on what's happening with other Sears properties that have shuttered recently?
Well, Sears has a holding company, and which is tasked with finding new uses and new tenants for Sears and Kmart that have gone out of business. So there have been a number of different ways in which those properties have been repurposed. And in one market, it became medical offices. In another market, they split the Sears pretty much down the middle, and half of it became a Dick's Sporting Goods, and the other half became a Dave and Buster's. The Kmart that is currently up for grabs is located on Route 1 in Rehoboth. It's a standalone store and is of a much more manageable size than the Sears at Concord Mall. So I would imagine that spot would be much easier to fill.
I was going to say, does the size make a big difference here in terms of, again, it's multi-floors and things like that? Does that make a big difference in trying to find someone to fill that space?
It does. It's a lot of space. Like you said, it's on two floors. And also, there are question marks about the mall that it's connected to.
Right.
So those factors, when you put them all together, makes it a tough one.
Another one of the anchor stores at Concord Mall that's kind of up in the air, at least its fate, is Macy's. There's no official word yet on Macy's there at Concord Mall, but Macy's is closing stores across the country. They're closing stores across the country. Is this store likely to be among the ones that are going bye-bye?
Well, Macy's is closing a lot of stores, 125 stores over the next couple of years. And it's part of a campaign for Macy's to reinvent itself. They've gotten the message, retail is changing, it's changing forever. And a big part of that strategy is getting out of what the company calls lower-tier malls. So however things progress with Concord Mall in its entirety will have a big impact on whether or not that Macy's stays in business. Macy's wants to be in strip shopping centers with smaller stores as well as more standalone stores. They don't like malls anymore.
And since your first piece, you also had a chance to check in with the new owners of the Concord Mall. What are they telling you about their plans for Concord Mall, maybe beyond what we thought we initially knew?
Well, the new mall owners say that it's their goal to bring in new and alternative tenants, and they want to create what they call efficient retail hubs that generate revenue and reinvigorate communities. They don't have any specific plans. They said that they want to reassure the people who are already there that they are looking for new tenants and that they are committed to making the mall a destination.
That's what they're saying. But in your initial story, you noted the company's track record was not necessarily a good one. In this update, you seem to have found some additional reason for concern. Can you tell us a little bit about what you found about their track record beyond what you reported previously?
In multiple markets, NAMDAR, the mall owners, have been taken to task for neglecting properties. In Hastings, Nebraska, they were ordered, the mall that they brought there was ordered closed last May by the fire marshal because they didn't get the building up to code. In Long Island, they were issued numerous citations at a shopping center for failing to remove rubble and fix potholes. in Mansfield, Ohio, one of their shopping centers was condemned because of safety concerns regarding electrical signs and exposed wiring. NAMDAR did fix the larger safety issues, but they had a subsequent harangue with tenants over who was responsible for other issues that were actually in the stores.
You also, in your latest piece, had a chance to take a look at how the future of the property fits in with planning that's going on along Concord Pike 202. Is there a sense of how this could fit in with this Concord Pike planning that's going on at this point?
I think that this is going to have a big impact on the new master plan for Concord Pike. Part of the plan, which is in the works, includes infrastructure that would have been compatible with the mall's previous owner's plan to redevelop the property into a mixed-use destination where people gather and shop and have dining. And so that included rebuilding the stream bed that runs behind the mall and installing bike and pedestrian paths that would make it easy for people who live in the 202 corridor to ride their bikes or walk to the shopping center and meet a friend and get a bite to eat, do some shopping.
Is it fair to say that looking ahead, you know, kind of the goal for people, at least locally, who live in the area, shop in the area, would be to kind of keep Concord Mall from becoming kind of like what the old Tri-State Mall on Neyman's Road became, which was kind of, in some ways, you know, kind of a ghost town, eyesore-ish type of place for a long time?
Yeah, I spoke with Dee Durham, who is that district's Newcastle County Council representative, and she says it's essential for people in the community to make their wishes known as to how the mall is maintained and developed, so that the community will have input into what takes its place, what is in that corridor that they drive past every day.
And I know you've had a chance to talk to a number of people kind of in the business, around the business, with experience in the business. In talking to all those people and the others you spoke to for this updated piece, did anything you hear kind of make you more optimistic about Concord Mall's future or maybe more pessimistic?
Well, the one thing that is optimistic is its location and that it is that big chunk of property. It does have infrastructure. It has sewer lines and electricity and water and those kinds of things. But I think that one of the things that is troubling is that there is no clear path forward. Like we talked about the bike paths and all that. Well, now it's a bike path to who knows where. And those kinds of infrastructure, those sorts of things that take time, are even more complicated when you don't know where that pedestrian walkway needs or should be built.
And I guess it's one of those things that's, you know, it's compounded by the fact that you have a company that kind of just has a bad track record, and even people in the industry are, you know, kind of looking at them and kind of shaking their head. Yeah, you know, you should be wary.
Well, I think that based on what we've learned through published reports and from people in the industry, yes, we should be wary. And I think that it's a good thing that the community and government is going into this with their eyes open, and they don't have to wait and watch and say, golly, things are kind of going down. Do you think we should do something about it? I think that there's a sense of anticipation, of being proactive, of saying, let's do what we can to make the most of this very important property.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time on The Green this week. Her update on the goings-on at Concord Mall is available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at a conference in Wilmington next week that hopes to help the First State enhance its place in the chemtech industry. Stay with us for that next here on The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Helping position Delaware as a chemtech industry leader is the goal of a conference in Wilmington next week. The Delaware Sustainable Chemistry Alliance hopes the event becomes an annual affair that brings science, chemical, and technical industries together and makes the first state a chemtech hub. The Chemtech Conference is February 19th and 20th at Wilmington's Chase Center on the riverfront, and the Alliance's executive director, Dora Cheatham, recently spoke to Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the conference and some of the topics it will cover.
All right, Dora, before we get started and talk about the first-of-its-kind Chemtech Conference coming to Delaware later this month, let's talk about the Delaware Sustainable Chemistry Alliance. Give me the background.
Okay, the Delaware Sustainable Chemistry Alliance was founded in 2010, and the idea behind it at that time was to really expand the discussion around sustainable chemistry. But as we delved into this, we discovered more and more that there is a huge innovation landscape in Delaware that we really are not aware about. And then what else we discovered was that these innovators that are coming out of places like the University of Delaware and things like that, they have specific needs that other innovators or startups or entrepreneurs don't have. So, for example, they innovate these technologies, but these technologies have a tendency to have this long route to market. It's not something that you could go to the bank and say, okay, I need a loan, and that's going to get me off the ground. These technologies have long development cycles, and it's hard to get them off the market. So what DESCA, which is what our acronym is, started to do was started to say, you know what, we need to help these innovators really understand how they can get their technologies to market quicker.
Now, last year, a year ago, DESCA board chair and White Dog Lab CEO Brian Tracy wrote an op-ed urging everyone to imagine Delaware as a leader in the chemtech arena. And the idea is really now one step closer as DESCA launches what it hopes will be an annual conference. So let's talk about the chemtech conference coming up in Delaware.
Right. So what's happening now is we have this great science landscape, technology. We have we have chemical materials, we have ag, biochemistry. All of this exists in Delaware, and this landscape is slowly changing. Okay, what's happening is these industries are moving from selling pure volumes of product to how do we integrate technologies into this landscape and use technology, maybe not to sell volumes and volumes of product, but to create greater value. And so what we said was, why don't we bring the chemical and science industry together with the tech industry and start that conversation together, and then also start getting the tech industry to see how much potential is here and how do we create more open innovation? How do we get these industries talking to each other and start looking at Delaware as a potential place for innovation, for technology, for investment into new technologies, new science, open innovation, and basically essentially a hub for all of these new things that are happening today.
Now, you are very pro-tech, of course. What do you say to the people who say, we've got enough tech, stop the tech? What do you have to say to that?
Well, actually, when you think about it, it's gearing towards sustainability, okay? So when you think about, ag is a perfect example, okay? So think about people who say we're using too many pesticides, we're using too many chemicals on our plants. So what if you had tech that's basically going through a farm of 10,000 acres and we're spraying 10,000 acres with pesticides? What if you had tech that could go through that farm and basically say, you know what, according to the data that we are gathering, you only need to spray pesticide on 3 acres of this farm because the rest of the acreage doesn't require this. This is the kind of technology that we're talking about. It's using less chemicals, less toxicity, less things like that to create higher value. Really working towards a more sustainable world.
We want to remind everybody we're talking to Dora Cheatham. She is with the Delaware Sustainable Chemistry Alliance, or DESCA for short. This two-day ChemTech conference is coming up on February 19th and 20th at the Chase Center on the Riverfront. Let's talk to people about what topics you plan to cover during these 2 days.
Yes, so what we're talking about, we're covering digital technologies and process improvement. So, for example, if you have this huge manufacturing plant, how can you use technologies in this plant to change the way that you operate things? How do you operate more efficiently in terms of video auditing and demand forecasting and things like that? So how do you function more efficiently? That's one of the topics that we're covering. How is digital changing the way that you view the customer? So historically, companies do not, the companies that manufacture the chemical itself don't talk to the end user. Okay, you know, if you're producing a chemical, you're going to sell it to someone who is going to put that chemical into an end product. But these companies also need to understand that they need to educate the end user as well. So how do you use the data and influence the end user and help the end user understand why the products that they are buying are effective, are better, why the newer chemicals, but help them understand the components that are going in there.
Dora, will the event feature any roundtable discussions?
We're going to have a roundtable discussion. Delaware Prosperity Partnership is going to host a roundtable discussion that's going to talk about talent in this arena. So what kind of talent is Delaware producing in this area, and what kind of talent do we need to produce as we go forward and the landscape changes? So there's going to be a lot of input in that as well.
All right, so give people the date again, and tell people, before you give people the date and that kind of information, where they can get more information. Do you think this conference, this ChemTech conference, will draw people from outside of Delaware?
It's already drawing people from outside of Delaware. So a lot of our speakers, they're coming from both from Europe and throughout the nation. They're coming throughout from Texas, from New York. So they're coming from throughout the nation and from Europe. And we're already getting people signing up coming internationally and from around the United States. So it absolutely is garnering attention from across the whole industry.
All right. Is there a website where we can get more information and sign up?
Absolutely. If they go to the Delaware DESCA website, is www.desustainablechem.org. And there is an entire page dedicated to this conference. And they can see what the individual, they can download an entire program on what the individual sessions are going to be about.
All right, some final words. I know you and I had a brief conversation off the air about how significant the chem, biochem, advanced materials, et cetera, industry is in the region, how it's changing, and how we can focus on driving a new legacy of innovation. But talk about that a little bit.
Well, the chemical materials, advanced materials, ag, bio industry, over the last few years, significant investment has actually been made in this industry. Over $700 million has been invested into Delaware over the past 3 years in the chemical industry, and the industry is heavily investing into innovation, and particularly open innovation. And that means it's, rather than holding all its R&D internally, more and more chemical companies are looking to collaborating with startups, with innovators and things like that to expand on its bringing new and innovative products into the market. And market itself has a combined market cap of more than $350 billion, which is 100 times larger than the state of Delaware. So the number of companies that you have out there, you've got and I know I'll be missing some, but you have DuPont, Chemours, Ashland, Solenis, Croda, Air Liquide, BASF, Invista, Agilent, Gore, Dow. I mean, there are so FMC.
Quite a few.
There are so many companies here, and so many people that don't even realize that a lot of these companies are located in this region. So what we want to do, we also want to make people aware of how much of this intellectual capital is located right here in Delaware. And of course we have, you know, in the University of Delaware, we have a really, really strong program in terms of, engineering, chemical engineering and things like that. So all of that really translates into innovation and benefits for the region as a whole.
Thanks to Delaware Sustainable Chemistry Alliance Executive Director Dora Cheatham and R. Kelly Steele for their time on The Green this week. And Kelly returns in just a moment with the latest arts playlist and more on a high-profile organist coming to Newark to perform this month. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. A renowned New York City organist is coming to Delaware next weekend for a concert dedicated to female composers. Gail Archer is an international concert organist, recording artist, and choral conductor and lecturer. Among the many hats she wears is director of the music program at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she conducts the Barnard Columbia Chorus. In this week's Arts Playlist, Archer offers a look ahead to her concert at the University of Delaware next Sunday, February 23rd, in her conversation with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele.
Gail, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hey, before we talk about your performance in Newark on February 23rd, give me some background about yourself.
Well, I've been playing organ all my life, since about the age of 13, and played piano before that, and always sang in choirs. So that story will be replicated by organists worldwide. They get started by singing in a choir somewhere when they're very young, and then are attracted to the organ. They are exposed to that music from their earliest days and just find something splendid about it, and that's my story. As an adult, I teach at Columbia University. I'm chair of music at Barnard College, the Women's College of Columbia University. I direct the two choirs here. My large choir is about 80 members, and chamber singers about 20. And I'm organist up at Vassar College, where I have a whole studio of organ students that I've developed over the last 12 years. So I do choir and organ, but in the context of two universities, rather than having a parish. I did have a parish for many, many years and played church services and directed church choirs for many, many years. But at this point in my career, I teach at the two universities and then play about 50 concerts a year nationally and internationally.
Why the organ, Gail? There are so many instruments. Why the organ?
The color, the sonic color and the variety and the creativity of all of that. I've always been drawn to that. Yes, you can play the piano, and there's splendid music for the piano. There's no question about that. I took many years of piano lessons along with organ. But then just organ, because the vast literature, it runs from the Renaissance to the present. I'm always commissioning new pieces from women composers particularly. I'm interested in how broad the possibilities are for just sonic diversity. I played the complete works of Olivier Messiaen, a great modern master, for the 100th anniversary of his birth in 2008. And Messiaen, among modern composers, puts all the registrations into a score because he was an organist himself. That's unusual. Most of the time, you get a little bit of an indication as to what the composer's thinking about. But with Messiaen, it's madly detailed, and that's a positive part of his art. And I became very attracted to that because he used the organ in a very unique way. And it's not only the spirituality of the music, as he was a devout Roman Catholic and very mystical, interested in the Church Fathers, in St. Thomas Aquinas, and the verses from the Bible or from the Church Fathers are throughout the music, and I found that very attractive. So this idea of a sonic universe that is virtually limitless is something that attracted me to the organ.
All right, let's talk about your upcoming performance in Delaware in Newark. Where are you going to be, and what will you be performing?
Okay, I was invited by my colleague Jennifer Barker, who's there teaching, and she's a woman composer also. So she asked me to play entirely women's literature. So that's what I'm going to do. The two of the pieces on the program are pieces that I commissioned. The first is by Joan Tower, who's my colleague up at Bard College here in New York State. She wrote the piece for the American Guild of Organists convention in 2016, but I worked on it with her while she was composing it so that I helped to orchestrate and decide the sonic colors in that piece. The piece is called Power Dance, and that's the first piece I'm playing. Then I'm playing another piece by Judith Shayton called Dust and Shadow. Judith is a professor of composition at the University of Virginia, Charlottesville, and I commissioned that piece in 2017, so I'll be playing that. And a piece by Mary Howe, who was in Washington, D.C. for many years, teaching Catholic University and involved with the arts in Washington. Let's go to Libby Larson. Libby Larson's piece, Aspires, teaching Catholic University and involved with the arts in Washington. Let's go to Libby Larson. Libby Larson's piece, Aspects of Glory, three movements, all inspired by hymn tunes. It's all women composers. So I'm also going to play a set by Jennifer Higdon, Ceremony Suite. She teaches down at the Curtis Institute in the Philadelphia area. That's a three-movement piece as well. What's interesting about it is that she actually wrote this as a piece called Ceremonies for a brass quintet and organ, but several of the movements were organ alone, and then she took out the three organ movements and published that as a separate piece. So that's what I'm going to play, three pieces for organ. I'm going to play three short pieces also by Nadia Boulanger, the great French teacher and composer, Prelude, Petit Canon, and Improvisation. And then finally, Jean Demessieu, her Te Deum Laudamus. She was a remarkable organist composer earlier in the 20th century. She died in 1968, and she is said to have memorized some 2,500 pieces in her life and played all over Europe, was a renowned organist, and had this prodigious memory. So I really feel it's very important for women musicians to keep her voice alive in the world. So that's the last piece on the program, is the Te Deum.
Gail, what do these works mean to you? They must mean something.
Absolutely. It is more difficult for women composers and women organists to find venues to have their music performed and to have opportunities to perform. Well-educated women struggle in this field. It's very, very difficult. I researched all the women organists in North America. It took me 2 years to do it. And the statistics were really startling. There are zero women leading an organ program at a conservatory in North America, as I'm speaking to you. There are two women teaching Oregon in a major research institution in a major city in the United States, one in Phoenix and one in Seattle. And there are two women who are cathedral musicians in a major U.S. city, one in New York and one in Houston. There are about 80 women teaching organ at colleges in the United States, but they're in small towns. I teach organ at Vassar College up in Poughkeepsie, New York. Yes, I have a flourishing program, but I don't teach here in New York City at all. I don't teach organ because there are such difficulties in moving forward in your career. Women find themselves blocked in various ways in various institutions. The more highly educated and skilled you are, the more barriers you face based on gender. And so it means a great deal to me to play music by women composers. Their voices must be heard in the world. They are marvelous creative artists. They deserve the attention that the public could give to them for the beauty of their music. And that seems a worthy mission.
Thanks to organist Gail Archer and R. Kelly Steele for being with us on this edition of Arts Playlist. Again, Archer's performance at the University of Delaware is Sunday, February 23rd at 3 p.m. Tickets are available at music.udel.edu. And we wrap up The Green Next with Enlighten Me, and a look at something we occasionally see this time of year along the Delaware coast, seals in need of rescue. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. A seal pup was found stranded on the beach at the Delaware Seashore State Park on Indian River Inlet last week. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schlino recently spoke with the executive director at the Marine Education, Research, and Rehabilitation Institute, Suzanne Thurman, about the seal and how to ensure these protected ocean mammals are safe when they visit Delaware during the winter months.
Saturday, a seal was called in to us, and it was located near the Indian River Life Saving Station that's within Delaware Seashore State Park, quite close to the Indian River Inlet Bridge.
Now, I've been in Delaware for a little over 2 years now, and this has happened a few times where seals wash up and the Murr Institute rescues them. Is this starting to happen more often, or is this kind of a normal occurrence?
Well, it's become a normal occurrence. We will expect to rescue several seals during the time of year when they are most likely to be here, which is typically between November through the end of April. They start showing up at the end of November and will head north towards the end of April. And we do also have some seals that will stay here even longer than that. There's a sort of a communal congregating area off of Lewis, where we see a number of these seals hanging out for extended periods of time.
And is that their mating season or something like that?
Well, seals do have very specific seasons of when they mate, when they give birth. So the seal that we rescued on Saturday was probably only 3 to 4 weeks of age. So it was at a stage where when seals are first born, they have a fluffy, light-colored fur that coats their bodies, and that's their baby fur. It's called lanugo. And once they start to get to the age where the mother seal is going to wean them, they start to lose that lanugo coat. So this little female that we rescued had lost most of her lanugo coat, but she still had it on her flippers. So all of her flippers were showing that. So we're using those indicators to tell us she was probably 3 to 4 weeks of age.
And was it called in by some beachgoers who knew to call the Murr Institute?
It was first sighted by some beachgoers, and they called DENREC. And just like all of the official entities in the state, they have our phone number. We're on call 24 hours a day for emergency response, so DENREC then passed the information along to us, the state park rangers, and staff at the Indian River Life Saving Station both alerted us.
So what's going to happen to the seal now that it's been recovered?
Well, it first has to be assessed and diagnosed. She was suffering from some wounds that were present around her neck and throat area, under her chin, and a few scattered along her body, her flippers. So we have to determine how severe these wounds are, if any infection has taken place, and there'll be other diagnostics that are performed. So we did our initial assessment and care and then transported her to the Marine Animal Rescue Program at the National Aquarium in Baltimore, where they will be able to do long-term care for her.
And will she likely stay there?
Well, she'll stay there through her recovery, and then she'll be returned to the wild.
All right. Anything else you'd like to add that we didn't go over?
I don't think so. Just I do like to remind people that this is seal season, and seals naturally have to get out of the water in order to rest. So it's fairly common to see them on beaches and docks and rock outcroppings and things of that sort where they are close to the water, so they feel safe, so like they can make a getaway if need be, but they can start to get some good sleep that they need. So we ask people to keep a distance of 150 feet, and if they do have dogs with them, to keep their dogs on a leash, both for the well-being of the seal and certainly for the dog as well. And to call us with any sighting of a seal, and we will go down and do an assessment. And our 24-hour reporting hotline is 302-228-5029.
Thanks to Marine Education, Research, and Rehabilitation Institute Executive Director Suzanne Thurman and our Nick Shalino for enlightening us this week. And that'll do it for this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrida, and Delaware Public Media's Nick Shalino, Sophia Schmidt, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.